My name's Joe, and I secretly recorded my boyfriend.
I don't know any names of women that are good-looking.
I'm not joking. He really doesn't know about this.
Like, Tom Cruise is a good-looking bloke.
Any closer to home?
Closer to home.
Join me and my two friends every week as we share far too much about our personal lives.
One of the first things him saying to me is that I'm not like other girls that he's been with.
That's great.
They were naturally pretty, whereas you do look better with makeup on.
Oh my days.
Search I Secretly Recorded My Boyfriend wherever you get your podcasts and tell everyone. Just don't tell him.
You?
Yeah, me.
No, you're on about pretty as in pretty.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degrees boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Again, huge thanks to them for wanting to be involved in this podcast, and their product is so good. I'm honoured to be associated with them. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's hour of conversation is 15 questions to Adam Hills. I suppose we best know Adam for presenting The Last Leg on Channel 4. Adam is a stand-up comic. He has been nominated for 3 consecutive Edinburgh Comedy Awards in 2001, 2002, 2003, his solo shows, The Edinburgh Fringe. Adam has had 15 stand-up tours, but I'm going to ask him 15 questions. What a terrible segue. I've amused myself how bad that is. Right, let's meet him. He's Adam Hills. Hi, Adam. How are you?
I'm well. I think I'm well.
Good. Okay. Well, the first question I want to ask you before we get into the questions is, I remember watching you on that rugby league match you played where you got knocked out.
Yes.
And I've always wanted to say, I'm not sure I've interviewed you since then. How are you since then? Because you look like you were knocked out cold.
I was out for, I think, about 2.5 minutes on the pitch. I remember making a tackle, and then I remember people calling my name, and I couldn't work out why people were calling my name. And I realize now it's because they were trying to wake me up. I mean, I followed all the strict protocols, the return to play protocols. So I had we had a really good physio who was kind of, as soon as it happened, was like, okay, here's what you've got to do. So there was no screen time for the next couple of days. I went and saw a specialist, a concussion specialist. There was no exercise for a week, and then I could gradually return to exercising. And he was great. He was really interesting talking about concussions, because it's a big part of sport, you know, as you know, whether it be football or league or union or whatever. And he said, concussions are only dangerous if you don't follow the protocols. So if you get knocked out, and, you know, a concussion is a bruise to the brain, basically. If you go back out again too soon and you hit your head again, that's when it becomes really dangerous. So he said, as long as you follow all the right protocols. I mean, I was a bit vague the following week on The Last Leg, I have to be honest. But no, absolutely fine now.
I think we have to point out it was for charity, wasn't it? And it was a charity rugby league match. Was it charity?
No. So I was playing disability rugby league with the Warrington Wolves disability team.
I thought it was Channel 4. That's why it was being filmed.
No, we filmed it as part of a documentary for Channel 4. But no, there was no charity involved. It was a proper try-saving tackle. It was only honour that was on the line that day.
Oh, okay. All right. Are you ready for these questions?
Yes, go for it.
What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
It's a piece of advice that I read. And it wasn't given to me. I read it in an interview, but it's something that I kind of, when I'm, you know, I've got daughters now, and when I want to talk to them about life, about jobs, about careers, it's what I say to them. And it's a piece of advice that I read. It was an interview with the singer Chris Isaak. And it was, what one piece of advice did you receive? And it was from his dad. And it was so simple. And I read it and went, oh my God, I've never heard anyone say this, but I completely agree with it. It was simply, turn up on time and be nice to people. And I thought, the more time I spend in this ridiculous industry that we're in, whether it be comedy or TV or radio or whatever, there's a lot to be said for turning up on time and being nice to people. And you can reduce that to a cheesy sentiment, or you can say, well, genuinely, you know, it's all, there's so many talented people that we come across in our jobs on a daily basis, loads of talented people, but you don't want to work with all of them.
That's very true.
And it's very true. To take it even further, I remember when I started out, I thought there were two things that you needed to be successful, talent and ambition, and or drive. Talent and drive. And you could get a certain distance with just talent, you can get a certain distance with just drive, but if you've got them both, you'll be successful. But I've realized since then that also it comes down to being the type of person that other people want to work with. Just someone who's nice, just good to be around. Like, there's so many people that I've met, you know, who are really talented and really ambitious, but my goodness, you don't want to spend time on set with them.
You know what? It's really interesting. Being someone on a show where we have to interview people, being nice goes so far, because if you've had a bit of a career and then your career stalls for a while and you want to come back, and we know who you are and we know that you're nice, and the bookers, because they do ask the presenters, you know, what we think, and they go, what do you think of this person? You go, oh yeah, that's lovely, put them back on. Yeah, let's get them back on. It really helps. And also, if you're nasty, what can happen is you know, you do get put, like, there's a black mark next to your name, and then the people go, should we put this person on Sunday brunch? And everyone at Sunday brunch going, no, the last time they came on they were horrible. But very few people are like that, I think. You know, the industry generally, he's got nice people, but, you know,
genuinely, but and also there's a lot to be said for just turning up on time, just being where you're supposed to be.
I had the same advice when I was at Big Breakfast. One of the senior producers said, always turn up in time and never steal. I don't know what his background was like, but that was his. All right, what's the best moment of your career?
The best moment of my career, and like, I've got to do some amazing things, but I always feel a little bit probably guilty, like, you know, well, you know, when you meet someone amazing, you kind of feel like, oh, I'm not, oh, I want to celebrate this, but I also feel guilty at the same time. But so for me, the best moment was being able to take my dad to the Australian Open tennis one year. And because of being on TV and knowing a few people and becoming mates with a couple of tennis players, I used to get kind of VIP tickets offered to me. And I'd always go on semi-final day because I knew everyone wanted to go to the final. So I'd get courtside tickets. We'd get a lovely dinner beforehand. You'd get to meet a few of the players. And one year I asked my dad if he wanted to come with me, because my dad got me into tennis. He taught me how to play. He, you know, took me to classes. He watched me play in competitions when I was a kid. So he was in Sydney, living in Sydney, and I was in Melbourne. So he came down. I took him to the tennis. We had a really fancy meal. But Rod Laver was the guest of honor at this particular meal. And of course, you know, my dad idolized Rod Laver. He was the hero, he was the best tennis player of all time. And towards the end of the day, I got to introduce my dad to a few people, you know, John Fitzgerald, Anton Woodbridge, both of whom have, you know, won Wimbledon doubles titles. And I was interviewed. And then as I was leaving, Rod Laver came over and introduced himself. And he said, I'm terribly sorry, I don't know who you are, but some of the people at my table do, and they'd like a photo. Do you mind?
Oh, amazing.
I said, of course. So I went over and got a photo with, like, I think it was maybe his daughter. And then I said, can I introduce you to my dad? And he said, of course. And I called my dad over, and he was just like a kid. I'd never seen my dad like that. And we chatted to Rod Laver for about 15 minutes, got a photo. Then we went in and watched the tennis. And then towards the end of the game that we were watching, which I remember was at that point the longest ever match in the Australian Open. I think it was Nadal against another Spanish player. And at the end of the match, a guy called Guillermo Vilas, who, very famous player, came and sat on the end of our row for some reason. I don't know why. I snuck off to the loo and I came back and my dad was like giggling. And I was, what? And he said, I just said hello to Vilas. I just went over and talked to him.
That's brilliant.
So I think we were both, he stayed at a hotel that night for some reason. Anyway, the next morning he said, my dad just said, I couldn't sleep. He said, I was awake till 4 o'clock. I was just thinking, right. Oh my God, I met Vilas and Laver. So of all the things I've done in my career, honestly, the highlight was being able to introduce my dad to Rod Laver.
Where are you more famous, Australia or Britain?
Probably Australia, to be honest. This is going to sound awful, but the way to answer the question is this way. Put it this way, I'm on a stamp in Australia.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they released Legends of Comedy series of stamps last year. I guess it was about March, April of last year. I'm on one of the stamps.
Holy crap, that's amazing. How did that make you feel?
I mean, it's probably the biggest honour you can get in Australia. We don't have knighthoods or, you know, MBEs or CBEs or whatever, OBEs. So I think, I mean, when I saw the other people that, and to be honest, the other people you probably wouldn't know of, maybe Magda Szubanski, who was in the movie Babe, but Gary McDonald and Nolene Brown were the other two. And I kind of looked at them and went, oh, no, they're proper legends. I shouldn't be associated with them. So as well as feeling not worthy, it is a genuine career highlight.
Is our royal family got anything to do with your country anymore? Is the Queen on your money or anything anymore, or is it all gone?
Oh, yes, the Queen's still on the money. She's on the back of the coins. She's on the notes, I think. But not necessarily. Yeah, she's on the notes. She's on the coins, but not on the stamps.
Right. Okay. Well, when I say that, you know, the best moment of your career, okay, there's got to be a moment there. The 2012 Paralympics, that has to be up there though, because you took a show which was going to last for, I don't know how many weeks, a month or something. Not even that, probably. Was it going to last about 3 weeks or something, that show?
And, well, ten, and 10 days.
Was it 10 days? Right. 10 days. And it's now run for, how many series have you been going for now?
I think we're on our 21st series.
I mean, how many weeks into the show, or days into the show, sorry, were you before you went, this is something? Because I remember watching it going, oh, this is brilliant. Everything, the theme tune, the attitude, the content, everything was great, wasn't it?
Well, the way TV, as you well know, the way TV works was we did it on the first night. We found out the next day we had something like 900,000 viewers, and we had no idea if that was good or bad or whatever. We got a great Twitter response. I remember going into the Olympic Stadium the next day, and one of my writers, because I was also doing stuff for the Australian coverage in 2012. So I went to the Australian studio first, and one of my writers texted me and went, oh, you better get down here. Things have gone bad. And so I walked into a meeting room with all the Channel 4 people, and there was this commissioning editor that had suddenly turned up out of nowhere and was basically telling us all the things we needed to fix about the show. Now, I later found out it was because the channel went, oh, this could be a thing. Let's really polish it. But it didn't feel like that on the day. It felt like we were being like punished for being naughty school children. So, and then later that day, another commissioner from Channel 4 said, what are you doing after the Paralympics? And I went, oh, I don't know. And she said, don't talk to any other channel before you talk to us. So I had this really weird, you know, after the first episode went to air, I had a 2-hour meeting where I thought, oh my God, this must be the worst show they've ever seen. But they also want to have a meeting with me at some point before I talk to any other channel. I couldn't work out whether they liked the show or not, to be honest.
But what you've done with the show, which I love, is you've given it a bit like we do on Sunday morning, where things can happen. And, you know, there's a point to it. Being on my show, point to it being live, stuff can happen on your show. Yeah. Like the time Chris O'Dowd decided to get absolutely leathered, right? And you decide to broadcast with him hammered. It's great television for us. We can go, yeah, let's watch this. And there's so many people saying funny things. And, you know, the other day you had Lorraine Kelly calling Piers Morgan a hero. I mean, that went viral when James Acaster said, fuck you. What did he say? Fuck that.
Go fuck yourself.
And it's like, whatever you think of Piers Morgan, it was just Lorraine Kelly, James Acaster, Piers Morgan swearing. It was, you know, your show creates moments, doesn't it? And there's not many shows on TV which are doing that anymore.
I think creates moments, but also embraces moments, because like we didn't know Chris O'Dowd was hammered. And I don't think, to be honest, I don't think he knew, because what had happened, he turned up. I don't think he'd had dinner. He'd had a few glasses of wine in the green room. He was topping up his own glass. We didn't really realize. Before we do the show, we do a little promo that goes to air like in Gogglebox or whatever, 15 minutes before the show. So he came out and did it, and it was fine. You don't have to say a word. It's just wave at the camera, and he wandered back. But when he wandered back, Josh came over and went, oh, I think he's a bit drunk. All right, okay. But bear in mind, he then doesn't get on air till another 45 minutes later. So he's gone off and had a few more glasses of wine. And as someone pointed out to me, they said it perfectly. I think it was Josh said, I don't think he realized how drunk he was until he tried to talk.
And I think, for anyone who's not seen it, go and YouTube it, because it's just, it's magical television. I love it when that sort of stuff, because it's you lot having to react to it as well and not knowing what he's about to say and the guests reacting. It's a beautiful piece of television. I do like stuff like that.
And I feel the same about your show, the episode where Johnny Vegas hosted.
Yeah, I wasn't on it.
Oh my God, that was joy to watch, because you just... That's the joy of live TV. You know, there's no safety net. You know that that person's going to have to dig themselves out of it somehow.
I want to move on with the questions, otherwise we'll never get through them. But just quickly on last leg, I'm sure we'll talk about it again. But we all knew Josh was funny. We know you're a comedian. Alex Brooker, what a find. I mean, just such a naturally funny bloke. Just a star in the making. Well, absolutely brilliant.
So I met Pete Thomas, was the guy who put the last leg together. He was the theme tune. He was the images, the graphics, all of that kind of stuff. And we'd met a few times. We'd started working on what the show was going to be. And we were at a Channel 4 press launch. And Alex was on stage as one of their new talents. And we all went out for beers afterwards. And while we were having beers and Alex was just being hilarious, Pete just looked at me and said, I want him on the show.
Yeah.
He said, I really think he's going to be really good on our show. Channel 4 want him as a reporter, but I want him on our show. Mm. And again, that first show we did, Alex was on because we couldn't find another guest.
Oh, he was great.
He wasn't meant to be a regular, nor was, I think Josh was always going to come on at the end and do the medal table. But Alex and I just had a thing, even when we did a little pilot, where the two of us both had our prosthetics off. We were comparing stumps and we were comparing what you do when you get an ingrown hair, like an infected hair follicle, because the prosthetic rubs against it. And I was telling him how if you grab a makeup pad and you cut the middle out of it, and you make a little circle around the infection so that it doesn't rub. And he was like, oh, never thought to do that. And Pete, again, the producer was watching going, oh my God, this has to be the show. This has to be the show. So it was a lovely accident.
Okay, I've asked you your best moment of your career. What's your worst moment of your career?
I'm pretty sure the worst moment is the worst gig I've ever done. I was living in Dublin. So I lived in Dublin for a while and I said yes. This is an example of don't say yes to a gig that you don't really want to do just because you're free and there's money in it. the offer was to host someone's stag night.
Oh no.
So there were a bunch of English guys coming over to a golf course in Cork and they wanted me to host the stag night. So I'd said yes, forgot all about it. The week before I went into my agent's office and I went, How long am I supposed to perform for? And she said, hang on, let me just make a phone call. And I'm overhearing this and I hear her go, yeah, we're just checking how long you want Adam for. And she went, no, I don't think he's available for the whole weekend. No, we were thinking more 40 minutes and then this. And then, well, it's not about how much it costs per minute. And I thought, oh, this isn't good. And she hung up and she said, they wanted you to go down and basically play golf with them and tell them jokes while they played golf and then host their dinner and then go out drinking with them and then do it again the next day for €400.
Wow.
So we bargained it down to like a 40-minute stand-up comedy set. And, you know, your body can do amazing things when it doesn't really want to do something. By the time I got to Cork, I had genuinely lost my voice. The only time in my life I'd lost my voice. And I was speaking virtually with a whisper. And I thought, I don't know how I'm going to be able to do this show, but I'm here. I have to give it a crack. And I turned up and it was in a golf course and they were all hammered. One guy was wearing a bra on his head out the front. And they were like, someone said, this looks like a comedian. And another guy went, no, he doesn't. He looks like a prick. I thought, this is not going to go well. I opened up, I did my... In those days, you know, I still tell younger comedians, start with your second strongest joke and finish with your strongest.
Right.
I started with my second strongest and it got nothing.
Oh, no.
And I kept getting nothing. And then I thought, I'm going to have to do the strongest here. So 5 minutes in, I pulled out the strongest joke and it got a tiny laugh. And eventually, so one of them put his hand up, I think, and said, listen, all right, listen. Like the politest heckle hand went up. And I went, yeah. And he went, it's not going well, is it? No. He said, but you've managed to get the stag to shut up, and that's more than we've done. How about you give it 5 more minutes and let's see where we're at after that then. So I gave it a couple more, and then eventually the stag came over, just walked onto the stage with a pint, 2 pints, and said, all right, here's the deal. You're shit. If you can down your pint quicker than I can down mine, we'll pay you. If not, you've got to entertain us for the rest of the night. And I went, yeah, all right. So we downed the pint. He won. And I was in like a suit and tie, and they were all in T-shirt and jeans. And I said, well, tell you what, I'm going to go back to the hotel and get changed. Where are you going? And they said, well, we're going to this nightclub. And don't lie to us because we know what room you're in. It's room 16. And I thought, well, no, it's not. It's room 12, but I'm not telling you that. So I went back to the hotel, got changed, went to the nearest comedy club where Reginald D. Hunter was performing, walked backstage and went, you're not going to believe what just happened. And he went, you need tequila. So we drank tequila for the night. I went back to the hotel room and I woke up at about 4 in the morning to hear them knocking on the door of room 16, trying to drag out whoever was in there.
Oh, great.
I've never done a gig since then that just like purely for the money.
All right, good idea. Right, what does success mean to you, Adam?
Well, success means the freedom to be able to say no to gigs like that.
Exactly, yeah, 100%.
You know what I mean? It's yeah. And more and more now that I've got kids, kids are a great filter, I find, as to whether or not a gig's worth doing. So before I might be offered a corporate event, do you want to host the BMW Awards or the British Pharmaceutical Awards or something like that? And you'd go, oh, yeah, that pays well. Of course I'll do it. But now I think, do I want to spend the night away from my kids that much? Would I rather watch Back to the Future and eat fish fingers with my kids on the couch?
Mm.
So freedom for me success for me is having the freedom to be able to say no to the things that I don't want to do.
A shrink I know has got a piece of paper, and on it he's got all the weeks that he's been alive.
Yeah.
And he's got them all in sort of red, and then in grey all the weeks that he's supposed to be left of his life, the average life expectancy for his age. He's also got another bit which is darker shade, is the life expectancy when he was born. And when you look at it, he says all he has to do is when someone asks him to do something, he looks at it and goes, nope, I haven't got enough time left. He says, you start valuing your time. And I thought it was a really lovely trick, that, because there is always that thing of a few more quid here, should I do that job? Should I do this job? And, sometimes when you're comfortable or even if you don't want to go out and do something, like someone asks you out for dinner and you think you can just look on the fridge, look at the graph and go, absolutely not. I don't want to do that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I read a biography of Robin Williams. I don't think it was an authorized one, but it documented an interview, a backstage meeting between him and Bette Davis, the famous Hollywood actress. And it was just as Robin Williams's career had started to take off. And she said, congratulations, your career's huge now. The next thing you need to learn is how to say no. Yeah. Really good advice.
But I suppose in our industry, and the listeners will go, oh, fuck you, you've got a great job and everything, but you're just terrified it's going to stop, aren't you, all the time? I've had this conversation with so many celebrities on this, and it's like, you keep saying yes to things because you've got that thing that if I say no, one day no one's going to want me.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, if you say yes to everything, you end up not doing a good job on all of it because you've said you've overstretched yourself. But you're right, people just forget. People don't realise how quickly this can all end.
Yeah.
And none of us have got, I don't know about you, but I haven't got a degree in comedy. I can't go back out and go, no, I've got all this experience, I'll be fine in the workplace.
Yeah, very true. All right, I love this question, changing tact a bit. What is your outstanding fashion moment? Could be bad or good.
Do you know what? I mean, not far from what I'm wearing today, to be perfectly honest, but so I'm wearing a t-shirt and a suit jacket.
Yeah.
But the difference between what I'm wearing now and my outstanding fashion moment was in the 80s, I would have had the sleeves of this jacket rolled up.
Love it.
A la Don Johnson, Miami Vice. And when I took the jacket off, the sleeves of my t-shirt would be rolled up ever so slightly over the bicep.
You're living in London. What I don't get is whatever the temperature is, if you go through somewhere where there's a lot of Australians living, they're in sliders or sandals. Doesn't that, like, what is that? Is that like what only Australians wear in Australia?
I mean, possibly. I've always thought you can tell Australians in winter over here because British people will dress. So British people on a cold day will go to their wardrobe and go, right, I'm going to wear this jumper. I'm going to wear this coat over the top and this scarf. And all of it's going to match, like, you know, whereas, and then the next day they might go, right, today I'm going to go this jumper, I'm going to wear this jacket, and I'm going to go with this scarf. Whereas Australians on a cold day will say, I'm wearing my jumper and my jacket and my scarf, because they've only got one of each and none of it necessarily matches. And if it gets even colder, they'll put on the other jumper that they've got with them.
I've got to say, I've never had a dull evening with an Australian. Australians know how to have a laugh. And I, when I traveled around America, I decided to travel around America for a while when I was a kid. And I ended up just traveling I've traveled with Australians, and then I traveled with a lot of Kiwis who had Kiwi badges all over them. And I'm like, why do you have so many badges? So we don't get accused of being Australian. I'm like, why does it matter? For God's sake. I met a Welsh person when I was out there. And I said, where are you from? He went, London, in a Welsh accent. I went, you're not from London. He said, oh, you're English. Sorry. Oh, I'm from Wales. I just say London because no one knows where Wales is. I mean, Wales is on the map now, but back then it wasn't, you know? So, all right. What do you do to keep fit? You just said you did rugby league. Anything else?
So I played tennis a lot as a kid, clearly. I played rugby league till I was about 12 or 13, but then having a prosthetic kind of made it a bit difficult. A few years ago, I discovered Warrington Wolves were starting up England's first disability rugby league team. And I've never been one for kind of fitness work. I don't enjoy running for the sake of it. I'm happily play tennis. I'll happily play rugby league or whatever, but I don't enjoy running for the sake of it. I don't even enjoy weights or, you know, workouts for the sake of it, to be honest. But since I found rugby league, in fact, just before rugby league, there was a disability triathlon that I was going to ask to take part in. And so I started training for what would be a para triathlon, which is 750 meter swim, 20 kilometer bike ride and a 5 kilometer run. And then as I got closer, it turned out I only needed to do a 1 kilometer run. So I tried to do that as fast as I could. But I then kind of rediscovered the joy of aiming at a target. And so since I've started playing rugby league, all I want to do, I don't like running. I still don't like running. I still don't like keeping fit, but I like doing it with the end goal of playing the best rugby league that I can. And especially at the age of 50, I probably haven't got that many years in me. So at the moment, I mean, up before COVID hit, I was training once a week up in Warrington with the team. And that was proper training. That was proper conditioning, fitness and conditioning and strength training, to the point where one night, I think a few of us, myself included, vomited after training because we'd been pushed so hard. But then once lockdown started, and this is for me, the joy of sport and mental health going hand in hand. Once lockdown started, the guys, our coaches, basically started setting us targets, exercises, routines to do over WhatsApp, and we would all do it. And recently we've all been trying to do 5K a day, whether it's a walk or a cycle or a run or whatever. And we're just urging each other on, and we're putting little, you know, messages up on the group. And now a few other kind of rugby league training drills are coming into it. So for me, it's having a goal, having something to aim at. But at the moment it's running, it's walking. And also I got to say, like, I used to have a stand-up routine about how much I hate healthy people.
Really?
Because they just bang on about it so much. But just a couple of kilometers walk every night makes such a huge difference, I've realized. So I've kind of become a bit of a convert, but I'm trying not to bang on about it too
much. We've discussed that on this podcast. It's really good for your brain too, doing the walk. Really, really good for getting the feelings, and especially if you're going through a bad time and any form of depression. Just asking you just a quick one, 2012 Paralympics, how important was that for setting an example for people with disability? Did you get a lot of feedback and how it encouraged people?
Well, I think every 4 years the Paralympics has the potential to create this little explosion of awareness and disability awareness and inspiration. And I saw it happen in Sydney in 2000. I think Athens was 2004, and it wasn't, to be honest, it wasn't done particularly well in Athens. But Beijing, like, For me, Beijing, one of the most amazing moments for me at the Beijing Paralympics was going to the Forbidden City and seeing an old man being pushed around in a wheelchair because for the first time ever, the Forbidden City had been made accessible.
Wow.
And I just thought,
brilliant.
You know, I didn't know this old guy's story, but maybe he'd lived to the age of 80 and never been to the Forbidden City purely because no one had thought to put a ramp in there for someone in a wheelchair. Mm. So those little explosions of awareness and inspiration come every 4 years. But after London, because of the job Channel 4 did with it, you know, with the, like I said, like you said, with the music, with the Public Enemy soundtrack, with the ads, but also watching the opening ceremony when Paralympics GB came out onto the field and fireworks went off and We Can Be Heroes by David Bowie was playing. Like, I remember watching that thinking, oh, I wish I was disabled. And then going, oh, I am. Awesome. And if, to be honest, this is the first time I then started feeling proud to call myself disabled because I wanted to be part of the cool group. Mm. And when you've got kids, you know, when you've got kids running like, you know, Richard Whitehead, who had two above knee amputations, where you've got kids trying to run like Paralympians, not because they're mocking them, because they look up to them. Yeah, it changed everything.
Is there a worry with the pandemic and the lockdown? I mean, a lot of sports are struggling, aren't they? The swimmers can't get in and swim.
Yeah.
No, but is there a worry this is going to have an impact on Paralympics? Well, it will have an impact, but how badly it's going to have an impact?
I think for the elite athletes, I think Paralympians are still classed as elite athletes, so I think they can still train to a degree. It's more the grassroots sports that I worry about. Like, you know, like I said, the guys in our rugby league team, there's 20 odd guys there with disabilities that would turn up every Tuesday for, you know, if you had said to them, hey, we're going to have a social club for men with disabilities every Tuesday to get together and just hang out and provide each other with a bit of support, no one would have turned up. But if you say, let's play disability rugby league every week, they'll turn up. But the byproduct is, we all have a chat to each other. We all help each other. If someone's having a down time, they'll post it on the group and everybody else will get on the group chat and we'll all bolster each other. So for me, I'm more concerned about that, about kids' sports, about grassroots sports, about people who rely on that weekly or bi-weekly or however often they're doing it, kind of rush of not just endorphins, but kind of social interaction that for their mental health. That's what I really feel for.
This is On My Last Eggs.
You get to a point in your life, you think, hang on, I'm kind of falling apart, everything's sagging, you know, what's going on?
A new podcast that talks frankly about being in the wild throes of menopause and perimenopause.
There's the insomnia, the anger, the rage, I mean, boiling, inferno, Vesuvial rage.
I'm Rachel New, and every week I'm going to explore more about these messy and confusing years with friends and experts, and if I can get one, a Spice Girl.
I get really cross with the word designer vagina. There's nothing designer about my vagina, I can tell you that now.
I'm having a real epiphany here, or as I like to call it, appropriately enough, an epiphany.
Find On My Last Eggs every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get yours.
And I love that title. Very good. I wish I'd thought of it. I really do.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
And by the way, in 2012, you, Alex, and Josh played a huge part in making it such a great event, I think, because I tuned in every night and it felt like you wanted to be part of it, which is important, I think. So, you know, you guys did a fantastic job in that.
It was, I mean, part of it was an accident. Part of it was because the head of Channel 4 at that time used to be Australia, well, was an Australian, Jay Hunt, and she knew a TV show in Australia from Roy and HG from the 2000 Olympics. It was a late night cult comedy show after the Olympics events had finished, and she said, I want this on Channel 4 for the Paralympics. But we knew that, and I knew from Beijing, that in order to cover the Paralympics successfully, you have to explain the sport and you have to explain the disabilities. So in a way, we didn't set out to go, hey, we want to make a show that changes people's perceptions about disabilities. We kind of said, right, in order to make the show we want to make, we have to make people feel okay with the disability. So it was almost a side effect of what we were doing. But again, for me, that speaks to the power of the Paralympics. It's the power of that single event to change lives and minds and perceptions. It's a much greater event than I think the people realize.
But I think art, humor, entertainment, they're so integral in changing people's minds on anything. As soon as you start putting it like the idea that we were being entertained by you guys with humor just meant, it was just made you feel part of something. And I'm repeating myself here, but that's the great thing about it. And I think at the moment with the pandemic, we can't wait to hear the comedians again, because I think humor is how to solve the problems we're going to have, I suppose.
Yeah, it's an interesting one with the pandemic. I've heard a lot of people say it, and I agree with it. I mean, we're lucky we have TV shows and we can still do our jobs, but the people that have got us through the pandemic a lot of the times are the artists, the comedians, posting stuff online for free, and they're the ones who are really struggling financially at the moment. So hopefully, the Roaring Twenties followed the Spanish flu in 1918, and hopefully, the Roaring Twenties might kick in again.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. Right, let's get on to another question for you. What were you like at school?
Oh, I was very diligent and disciplined and a bit of a goody two shoes or a goody one shoe at school.
So I'm not sure I'm allowed to laugh at that.
I did all the work I was meant to do. I never really got into trouble. I wasn't even like the class comedian. The only times I would be is if I had to give a presentation to the class or a speech. Or eventually I got into debating. So like join the school debating team, and I'd always throw jokes into that. I got to deliver the kind of end of school leaving ceremony speech to the school, which I turned into a comedy routine. So I was like a proper, and in fact, there was one teacher, I was talking to someone about this recently. There was one teacher who really set me on my path. So I always had good reports. I always did well. I did all the work I needed to do. Everything was handed in on time. And so parent-teacher nights, my parents were always told, Adam's a good student. He's doing everything he needs to do. Great. But this one maths teacher, Mr. Chisholm, said to my mum, nah, he's just flexing his muscles. And she said, what do you mean? And he said, he's only doing what he needs to do. He's not pushing himself. He's not trying harder. He's not doing any extra work. And I remember thinking, well, screw you, I'll show you. So I worked my ass off. And then maths was my best subject. So even though I don't necessarily use maths now on a daily basis, I take that attitude with me.
Good psychology. I'll go into the next question, which is what other jobs did you do? Have you done proper jobs apart from comedy and TV and stuff we do?
Yeah, so let's see. I started at university. I went to university from high school and studied a degree in arts, but majoring in mass communication. So like radio, TV, film, that kind of stuff. During that time, I worked as a tennis coach. That's when I started coaching. So at one point I was coaching 6 days a week, every afternoon after school and after university, and then a Tuesday night and then Saturday morning. So I was on a tennis court 6 days a week. And then what came after that? And then I started, I worked as a stagehand at a TV station. So building the sets, I'd get there in the morning and help build the sets. And then I'd run around after a camera person, making sure they didn't trip over the cable, did all of that stuff on the floor. And then we'd pull the sets down at the end of the day. So I think that gives me a huge appreciation for everyone that works on our show. And you know what? It made me realize when I did it, I didn't think it was a very important job. I just thought, I'm just, no one cares whether I get this job. I did it to my best, But now that I'm, you know, a host of a TV show, I kind of look at everyone, regardless of what their job is, and think, man, I couldn't, if one of you didn't do your job, then that's going to reflect badly on me. So I'm so grateful for everyone that does those jobs. And then I started doing stand-up comedy, although that might have even come before any of it, to be honest. And then from there, a friend and I sat up one night. A friend and I were the support acts for Britain's Naughtiest Hypnotist, a guy called Peter Powers, who's still going today.
Okay.
And mainly due to bad promotion, the show folded after a week. And she and I, this other comedian and I, were sitting up at one in the morning thinking, well, now what are we going to do? So we literally got the papers as soon as they hit the newsstands, which was about 3 in the morning, went back to her place, wrote a whole bunch of jokes and faxed them off to a radio station that had a comedy breakfast show and said, hey, we're just a couple of comedians. Here's a whole bunch of jokes. Thought you might like them. Got a call the next day. It turns out they had advertised in the paper for a job and we didn't even see that. We had just, and they thought our job application was sending in a whole bunch of jokes.
Amazing.
Two of which made it to air that morning and they went, right, you've got the job.
Oh, brilliant. How was it? Do you enjoy it?
Loved it. I mean, it was hard work. We'd start work at probably 4:30 in the morning.
I love radio because was it music radio? Did you have music on it? Oh, I love music radio because you can punctuate things with music. So it's a great, once you learn how to drive the desk, you can talk and punctuate and it's just that lovely life feel. I love it. It's just, it takes up a lot of time, doesn't it? You have to go 5 days a week. It's a lot of hours and a lot of preparation.
It is, but it's the perfect training for doing live television and doing, when you were talking before about embracing those moments, I was thinking that's one thing that, you know, your show and our show has in common is it's virtually a radio show.
Yeah.
The difference is, well, you do. I was going to say the difference is you don't have music. You do have music and you have cooking and you have chats.
I love it when things go wrong on our show. That's when I get paid my money, because when stuff's, happens where it breaks or the lights go out or anything which happens like that, that's when I earn my money and that's what I like. So for me, the worse that things happen, the better it is for me. Can I go back a stage and just ask you a quick question? Does your disability with your leg or foot, does that have any impact on you playing tennis then?
A little. So yes, if I didn't realize this until I became a coach, if I run backwards for a smash, so if I'm at the net, someone puts it up over my head.
Yeah.
If I run backwards, I should jump off my right foot because I'm right-handed and land on my left. And I didn't realize until I was coaching that we were taught to do that. The guy watched me and went, what are you doing? I realized what I do instead is jump off my left and then land on my left. So
amazing.
It's weird on my body. It probably affects a little bit of lateral movement and maybe a little bit of speed around the court, but to be honest, not that much. I played to a pretty high standard. I played A grade men's. I was never going to be professional. I was never going to get to that level, but it didn't. I remember playing in Adelaide once with my brother, and we went to Memorial Drive, which is the main tennis courts in Adelaide. And we were playing pretty full on. My brother was a good player as well. And one of the groundsmen that worked there kind of stopped and watched a few points. And then he looked at me and he went, you're very brave. And then just walked off. And I couldn't work out why. I was thinking, well, what? Because I came to the net on a second serve? Why? But then I realized that, you know, for him, a guy with one leg running around a tennis court like that was an amazing thing to watch.
Isn't it great the way the body adapts, though? The way that you've gone, well, not even adapt, it's the only thing you could do, and you go up on the wrong leg, and it's just brilliant how it works like that.
Yeah. I mean, my left leg is really strong. It's and to the point where I need to now start working on my right, because now I get lazy and I make my left leg do all the work, so it kind of throws my back out a little bit. And that's the thing that my prosthetist said to me as I got older. He said, when you're young, you can do stuff like that and your body will be fine with it. But as you get older, you need to find a balance a little bit more, because your body will start to hurt a little bit more.
Okay, next question. When was the happiest you've ever felt? Could be a moment, a year, or anything.
I would say the happiest I've ever felt was when I found out my wife was pregnant with our second child. And the reason I say that, no disrespect to our first child, I'm going to have to explain this to her one day, and I'm sure she's going to end up in therapy, and I can't explain why she shouldn't. But so that feeling when I found out we were pregnant the first time, there was a fear attached to it. There was a, oh God, what's going to happen? What kind of father am I going to be? What's it going to be like having a child? How's this all going to work? There was joy and excitement, but there was fear of the unknown. And then when I found out we were going to have a second child, because the first one was so great, I absolutely loved being a dad so much the first time, that when I found out that was going to happen again, I was so overjoyed with, oh, great, we get another one of those. It's like going on, I don't know, it's like going on a roller coaster for the first time, and you're scared and you don't know what to expect, and then you absolutely love it. And then a few years later, you find out you get to do it again, and you're like, yeah, let's totally do this. So, and also that it meant that, you know, I grew up with a brother, so there were a younger brother. So there were four, mum and dad and myself and my brother. And for me, that's what a family was. So the idea that we were going to have two kids, that they were going, you know, they were going to have siblings, that we were going to be a family, I think that's the happiest I've ever been.
That's good. How's your mental health?
At the moment, I'd say up and down. I'd say good days and bad days, good hours and bad hours. I mean, it's a weird thing at the moment because I'm away from my wife and kids. But I found that especially during the pandemic and during lockdown, we had a really strict lockdown in Melbourne last year, and that was tough. I found anyone that lived on their own was craving human contact, and anyone that lived with their family was just craving some quiet time.
Yeah.
Carving out a bit of time to get out of the house, to go and kick a rugby league ball around, to go for a bike ride, just to be in my own head was really, really important. To be honest, the biggest thing that got me through was most nights after dinner, I'd just say to my wife and kids, I'll do the dishes, I'll clean up the kitchen, and I just put my headphones in and I just listen to music for half an hour and just shut everyone out. They could go and watch a TV show or whatever. Because I felt like I was doing something useful, I didn't feel guilty about it. Mm. And I'd clean up the kitchen, put the dishes away, do everything I could, and just listen to music. So it's interesting, isn't it? I find a lot of blokes my age, you know, I'm 50 now, are having more and more issues. I'd love to find out if there's an age related thing, if something happens to you at a certain age where it becomes a bit more of a struggle, whether it's, you know, your own impending mortality, whether it's, I don't know what it is, but I'm finding it helps not to get too down on myself when I get down on myself. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like if I'm having a down day, just go with it. And as you said before, if I don't feel like going out, if I don't feel like catching up with people, especially at the moment, you know, pandemic wise, but just acknowledge when I'm not really up for it.
How much time do you spend in Australia in comparison to Britain these days?
It's a bit all over. So my wife and kids moved back to Australia in September 2019, mainly because my kids wanted to go back to school there. They were getting homesick. My wife had some work there as well. And so we thought, well, that's fine. I can do the last leg 10 weeks at a time and then go back home for a few months and then come back here. And then, of course, a few, you know, 3 months later, the pandemic hit and everything was thrown out the window. So this last year I spent, I'd say, 8 months in Australia, 4 months here. This year's up for grabs. Like I'm going back home in a couple of weeks. I should be there for 8 or 10 weeks. But then depending on the way, whether the Paralympics happen this year, whether Australia takes quarantine hotels off the list, whether you still have to do it, I might be here for another 6 months. But the thing that gets me through it is my dad worked for Qantas. My dad was Qantas cabin crew. So I grew up having a dad on the other side of the world for, I'd say, 2/3 of my life. So for every day, every 2 days he was away, I think it was, he'd have to be back for one. So if he was gone for 10 days, he'd be home for 5. If he was gone for 20, he'd be home for 10. So I kind of grew up having a dad that was away a lot of the time. And I don't think it affected me. I think it made me appreciate him more when he was around. Like I'd come home from school at 3 in the afternoon and dad was just there and we'd hang out all afternoon. So to have a dad on the other side of the world doesn't seem strange to me.
The next question, what's the key to good relationships, which will be interesting because you've had different ones and they've been all around the world. So,
I mean, one of the keys is spend time away from each other every now and again.
You know what? That is the answer that most people give, is have some time to yourself. I think that seems to be one of the keys that I'm witnessing here, is if you spend too much time on top of each other in a relationship, whether it be friends or partners or parents or anything, I think you get on each other's nerves a bit, and I think you need a bit of space.
Well, there's a great thing I heard about, or I read about, you know, when having kids, and it was the example they gave was about having time for yourself. You know, when you're on a plane and they give the safety demonstration, they say fit your oxygen first before fitting a child.
Yeah.
Because if you're not breathing, you can't help your child.
Yeah.
And it said the same about parenting. If you're not fulfilling yourself, if you're not getting time to yourself, then you can't devote your time to your child. And probably the same applies to a relationship, I would say. If you're not going off and feeding your soul, then you can't help someone else's.
Brilliant. I think the thing with parenting is you have to be set a good example to them. If you're miserable, and there's a lot of parents out there at the moment, I talked to Philippa Perry about this, who's the psychologist. There's a lot of parents out there who thrive on how much they're suffering for their children. And so basically you're showing your children that when you're an adult, you suffer, rather than actually showing your children a good example that you're having a great time. She went on to say, if you enjoy your work and you're going to work and they're going, Daddy, where are you going? You go, I'm going to work because I love it. And show them a good example of what you want to do. Hey, why don't you come and look at it one day with me and see how good work is, rather than always being miserable. I suppose that's such a great idea to put it in relationships too. So I've got to have a great time and so do you. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, and I say that to my kids a lot. Like, you know, I know I'm away from them, but I think if they can see me doing a job that I love, then maybe they'll aspire to do a job that they love.
I don't know if you've ever done this in any of your comedy routines or anything, but the analysis between Britain and Australia. I've never been to Australia, and I'm worried that if I went there, I'd realise that I've missed out, because I love sport. Australians are great at sport, and it seems to be such a big thing in Australian lifestyle, outside, always doing stuff. And I love that. My problem with Britain often is all my mates want to do is go into a pub and drink. And I was like, can't we do something else instead? You know, can't we go and those summer nights that we actually did go out and like play baseball at work or something were to me just dreamy things. And apparently that happens all the time in Australia. What do you notice the real differences are between Australian life and British life?
Well, a really good example of that is, I remember talking to my manager once, and I think we were talking about football, and he said, oh, listen, if you ever want any tickets to the football, I can sort you out. He's a West Ham supporter. So I'll sort you out, get your tickets to West Ham, no worries. And I went, yeah, cool. He said, anything you want. And I said, you know what I'd love? This is when I first started coming over here. So I'd love, if you can ever get your hands on Wimbledon tickets. And he went, ooh, tennis, it's a bit of a posh boy sport. And I went, what? And he went, oh, yeah, where I grew up, you get beaten up for playing tennis.
Yeah.
I went, really? And he went, oh, God, yeah. Cricket was all right. Football, fine. Tennis, nah. Whereas where I grew up, public tennis courts were everywhere. You could either call up the local council and book a tennis court, or just turn up with your mates and a couple of tennis rackets and tennis balls. And if there was no one there, you could just play. I was utterly shocked to think that there was a class system. Well, to do with any sport, really, but in particular to do with tennis. Tennis just felt like the working class game in Australia. So I think that's one big difference between sport here and sport in Australia. Maybe rugby union in Australia might be considered a bit of a posh boy sport, but apart from that, it's all open. And I wonder, that's a really good question. I remember having a conversation with a comedian called Steve Hughes, and he had a theory on why the English service in the hospitality industry was notoriously terrible. And he said, I remember him going, it's the class system, mate. It's the class system. I said, what do you mean? He went, right, put it this way. If you're in England and you work behind the counter of a shop, that's all you're ever going to be, because the class system has told you since you grow up, you work behind the counter of a shop, don't get high ideals. That's as far as you're going to go. If you're in Australia and you work behind the counter of a shop, you might own the shop one day. You might own a franchise of shops. You might own like shops all around the country, and suddenly you're a billionaire. There's no limit. So of course you're going to be nice to people when you're behind the counter, because eventually you might be one of them. You might be top of the tree. And it was a really fascinating way of describing things. And I wonder often how much that class system, that subconscious class system in Britain is still in play in a way that it isn't in Australia.
When I got into TV, everyone told me to remember where I was from, and people like me don't get jobs in TV and stuff. I remember that happening a lot. And then,
wow.
Yeah, but it was understandable why people thought that. And I'm just out from Hertfordshire, and I had a lovely upbringing and stuff. It was fine, you know, it was just normal state school. I didn't go to university or anything. And I think that's why I think people thought you probably had to go to university to get into TV. There was probably a lot of that back then. However, I don't know whether people do it because it's a survival mechanism, because we've got a huge population in this country, really, for such a small country, haven't we? And I suppose that the opportunities to move around the, let's call it classes, maybe quite hard. So you kind of try and take happiness in where you're at, maybe. I don't know. It's an interesting question, though.
Possibly. I mean, I think in Australia, there's no limit to how far you can go. There shouldn't be. The sky's the limit.
I think I should do a podcast on it. That's what I think. I think I should find someone who knows about this. Have you ever tried playing Aussie rules football? Because that looks like such a good sport to me.
Yes. Yeah, I have. I grew up in Sydney, and in Sydney and in New South Wales, it's more rugby league. So that's why I have an affinity for rugby league. I played Aussie rules football a few times. It's a different way of kicking the ball. It's a different style of football. And eventually I moved to Adelaide, where Aussie rules was played. So I watched it a lot and really got into it. But it's not my natural way of, of playing with a ball.
You have to be so fit and so hard to play that game, don't you? It's such an incredible game.
It might be a myth, but I read that it was invented to keep cricketers fit in the off season.
Right.
Because the idea was it wasn't meant to be quite so, you know, high contact. But yeah, that's nuts. Especially when you see what was hilarious when I lived in Dublin for a while, and I used to go to the compromise rules games.
They were horrific. That Gaelic football versus Aussie rules.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That just stopped them in the end, didn't they?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it was pointed out to me that, if you look carefully, and it didn't occur to me until it was one of my Irish mates that said, have a look at all the Australians are professional athletes. This is what they do full time. All the Irish guys are farmers and butchers and kind of who also play on the weekends. So there's, you know, the level of fitness that those Aussie guys have is ridiculous.
The level of violence in those games was just off the scale. Actually, rugby league's a really fit game as well, isn't it? I mean, I think it's so amazing in rugby league when the player goes down injured, and rather than stop the game, the doctor or whoever it is comes running on and treats them whilst the game's still going on. I'm always like, that's what sports should be like. Just keep going. I don't know how fit you have to be to play rugby league, but it looks incredible.
I mean, I've got very fit in the last few years. It's full on. And I've had I've talked to union players who have kind of said, oh no, that's rugby league is a different level. It's a very fast game.
Just doesn't stop. Right. A couple more questions. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
Oh, so when I first met my now wife, we drove around Ireland. I had a few gigs in Ireland, and we stopped in a place in, I'm pretty sure it was Armagh. And it was a hotel that used to be an old convent of some sort, and went out for dinner and went back to the hotel and all fine. And in the middle of the night, I had a really weird dream and woke up out of it and kind of went, oh, there's a presence in the room. I really felt like there was something in the room. And I was like, oh, this is awful. This is awful. And I kind of said out loud, you know, because I'd seen it on TV shows, I'm not here to cause you any harm. You can go on your way. Please leave me alone. And I was away for about half an hour and eventually drifted off to sleep, thought nothing more of it. And then the next morning at breakfast, you know, the people who own the place came round and what would you like for breakfast? And then the woman said, did you see our ghost last night? And I went, what? She said, yeah, apparently we have a ghost here. I've never seen it, but people tell me about it. And I was like, yeah, I did have an experience actually. And then when I checked out, the guy behind the desk said, so I hope you enjoyed the stay. And he went, didn't see the ghost, did you? And I, yeah, I totally did. I totally saw the ghost, or at least I felt the ghost.
Yeah, did you? You didn't see it. You just felt the person. It.
My brother had a similar thing. So my brother was living in New Zealand for a while, and he hosted a TV show called Ghost Hunt, where they would send people into a haunted house with infrared cameras to see if they kind of felt anything or whatever. Yeah. And there was one house that he came back from, and for like the next 2 weeks, every night in the middle of the night, his kettle would go on for no reason. And he'd wake up in the middle of the night going, what is that noise? And going, what, the kettle? Why is the kettle on? He'd turn the kettle off and go back to bed. This happened for a few weeks. And then he went to Sydney to visit, to stay with my mum. And when he went back to New Zealand, it stopped happening. But after he left my mum's house, it happened to her every night.
Right.
So she would wake up in the middle of the night and her kettle would be on for no reason.
What do you think, ghosts are? Have you got a theory on it?
Look, energy. I think if we're going to run with that and think that there might be something, we're all made up of energy. Like matter, you know, it's a scientific fact that matter is just energy vibrating at different levels. So we're all vibrating, like we're all made up of protons and electrons, and we're all vibrating, and that's science. So if we're all made up of energy, then that energy has got to go somewhere. And maybe, I don't know, but maybe when people die, that energy doesn't move on. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
But do you think it's conscious? Because we don't know where our consciousness is, do we? I mean, we assume, I suppose, it's in our brains, but we don't know where it is. Are we thinking consciousness is energy? Or is it connected? Oh, God, we're going way off our depth here, aren't we, Adam?
I mean, there are those things where, you know, where people say that they've said to an apparition, like, you don't need to be here anymore. You know, you don't live here anymore. You've moved on, and then that apparition will move on. So is that talking to a conscious mind? I don't know. Mm. I don't know.
I spend a lot of time listening and reading about consciousness at the moment. It intrigues me no end. Final question. Perfect way to end, actually. What is the meaning of life?
The meaning of life, I'm going to quote my grandfather, who is still alive. He's 102.
Wow.
He's in a home now, unfortunately, but he's still totally with it. And I remember visiting him once, and we were sitting on the back balcony and we were having a beer. And he said, "Do you know what the problem with the world is, Adam?" And I was like, "Oh God, here we go." He said, "Religion. Religion's the main problem in the world." And I went, "Right." And he said, "Do you know what my religion is?" And I went, "No, what?" And he said, "Family and helping people."
Mm.
And I ended up doing a show where I kind of talked about that as being my religion as well. But I think the meaning of life is family and helping people.
Perfect.
By the way, I genuinely think that's what we're here for. Just
by the way, if you ever want to see a great TV show, Most Haunted with the Happy Mondays is just truly amazing. It's on YouTube,
right.
And it's like a proper, it's like an episode of Scooby Doo. If I can't believe a commissioning editor hasn't commissioned the Happy Mondays to go around to haunt it and just give them a dog as well. You know, it's put them in the mystery van or whatever that thing's called. It would have been, honestly, it's great. Thanks so much for doing the podcast, Adam. Really lovely to speak to you today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Adam. Cheers.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.